This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to Province Sports Radio, our somewhat occasional podcast here. I'm Paul Chapman, joined by Ed Willis.
Yes, we will endeavor to turn this into a more regular exercise. Unfortunately, I got distracted by the Seattle Seahawks' aborted playoff run, so that took care of that. But we're gonna try and be a little more consistent about this.
I was distracted because I now have to clean the windows and vacuum the newsroom before I get to these duties. As Jonathan McDonald is no longer with us as sports editor, so we've had to divide up his duties there. And I will not make cookies for the rest of the staff. I'm sorry,
but he will always be with us. I think we should have a moment of silence for Jonathan right now.
All right, Ed, let's jump right into it. We have to start with the Canucks, and I find this particular period of where this team is in terms of the frame of where they've been as a franchise since they started in 1970, I find where they are at this moment to be horrendously interesting because I don't think they've ever been in this sort of at this kind of intersection before.
Yeah, it's an interesting. So we're doing this on Thursday, and they're playing the San Jose Sharks tonight, which I find an interesting bit of timing because the Sharks have succeeded in doing what the Canucks are trying to do, and that's rebuild on the fly, or however you want to characterize it. You think back to that 2011 playoff series where the Sharks were where the Canucks were at that point, and it was widely assumed the Canucks were far ahead in a position to maybe, you know, secure a 2-3 year run at the top of the league, where the Sharks had to address an aging core to stay competitive. Well, they've done it. Not only they've done it, they've done it spectacularly well, and the Canucks are trying to get to where the Sharks are right now. It remains to be seen where they'll do it. But I think these last 2 months of this season, the last 32 games, is really almost going to be a plebiscite on the organization and where they are now, because these are the games that mean something, and their schedule is not in their favor. So this is going to be appointment viewing, I think.
Well, I mean, when I agree with you 100%, and that's where I look at it as them literally being at an intersection. Do they just let things take the natural course and see what this team can do, or are they tempted to think that they can do more and make a huge move at the trade deadline? I think that's not just a possibility. It's a fear for most Canuck fans.
Yeah, I think, and I don't see this happening. Not at all. I could see like lower level moves like they've done at the in and around the past two deadlines. I'm sorry, I'm a little fuzzy the timing on the Berchi trade. It seemed to me that was the deadline 2 years ago. And then the Granlund trade seemed like lower level moves, but they played out well for them. And I could see them doing the quote unquote hockey trade as far as coming out of their comfort zone to land that piece that might aid them in a playoff run. I just don't see that. Then, judging by the comments that have been made publicly, I don't see that happening. I think the more interesting question is, would they move a veteran piece to try and accumulate assets? And that's fair, and what we'll see.
That is the other shoe. I mean, you can try and get a piece that would help you actually, if you believe, well, no, we are a playoff team, and move a second rounder, but we've seen how, you know, those eroded the progress of this team over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. Or what if someone comes in with a great offer for a Hanson or Burroughs?
Yeah. Well, and again, I think it'll be determined by, you know, what's coming up here. I mean, they've got 32 games left. It seems to me 24 of them are against teams that currently hold a playoff spot. They've got 5 games against the Sharks, 3 against the Oilers. So, I mean, it doesn't take a great deal of imagination to see them falling out of the playoff hunt. And then they'll have to face these decisions. And, you know, could they accumulate to, you know, those names you just mentioned? Yannick Hansen's a different character because to me he is so valuable. Both the quality of player is and that contract is so portable. I think he would fetch a hefty price. And I also look at Alex Edler, and I know he's got a no trade, but I think they've gone just about as far as they can with him, and they've got younger defensemen coming. To me, he'd be the classic player that teams look to add at the deadline, you know, a veteran defenseman, not a top pairing guy, but a guy who would fit, I think, in the top four in virtually any team in the league. So those are the more interesting questions for me as they charge down the stretch.
I actually am really enjoyed this Canucks season only because I think our expectations of not just what the team would do, but the storylines within the team were so flat, maybe going into training camp, and so many things have happened. One of those, and frankly, as long as I've been following the Canucks, I've never seen anything like the development of their blue line within 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, if nothing else happens this year, just the fact that Troy Stetcher and Nikita Triamkin have emerged as a legitimate NHL defenseman, that's a massive, massive development for the organization. I think they're close. I mean, this has been the Achilles heel of the Canucks ever since they came into the league. You can count on one hand the amount of times they have had, you know, not even an exceptional, but an above average NHL defense. And now all of a sudden they have these two, plus they've got Ylevi coming, plus they've got Chris Tanev's kind of in mid-career. So that and their goaltending is clearly the strength of the team. And that's something, that is something. Now all of a sudden you're just looking at adding, you know, maybe another impact, two impact forwards, and you've got the makings.
And if you believe Bazer is one of those guys, as most people,
yeah,
you know, it hasn't been hype, but I haven't sort of seen universal praise of a Canuck prospect. And they've obviously within the U.S. college system, I think you afford more patience with players who are there over junior. But yeah, if he is a real prospect in the development of Bo Horvat, you're right. It wasn't a full-scale, oh my God, we've got to do everything we can to burn it to the ground and build over again.
Yeah.
But things have happened nicely for them.
Well, and again, so let's go back to the San Jose model because, you know, if you believe what they've done. So again, look at 2011. Well, okay, they get so lucky the next offseason because they make the trade for Brent Burns. And who could have, you know, yes, he was going to be an impact player. And yes, they thought he had a chance to, you know, really be a key contributor on their team. But at age 30, he's all of a sudden emerged as a Norris caliber trophy defenseman. He might be the best player in the league right now. And he's changed everything for that franchise. They go out and they get Marty Jones as their number one goalie. That was a bit of a risky move. He'd only ever been a backup. Yeah, everybody liked him and, you know, what he represented. But he's a legitimate number one goalie. And that core hasn't aged nearly as dramatically as others have around the league. There's just not a lot of teams that have two 37-year-olds in their top six like Marlowe and Thornton. But you add that all together now, and you know, you've got that spine, to borrow the soccer term, and it makes it so much easier to add the pieces around it. So now you put a Melker Carlson in, or you put the Donskoy kid in, and they're pretty good players. They're not world beaters, but they fit into it with what the Sharks do, and that's kind of the challenge in front of the Canucks.
It's an interesting year that way as well, where I think you look at some teams that maybe were really expected to contend, like in LA, certainly a St. Louis, who obviously just fired their coach, and then you see these progressions by, I have to chuckle every time I mention Columbus, but still, and Minnesota. So yes, San Jose are there, as are Washington, who were one of the top teams last year, but we frame this for the Canucks over the last 32 games. What are you seeing into heading into the trade deadline and into the playoffs for the teams around the NHL? Do you think this is wide open, or do you think we're once again looking at a collection of four or five teams who have a chance to win?
Yeah, I'd have to do a deeper dive into it. I think there are like half a dozen teams probably. You know, let's just tick them off. There's Pittsburgh. There's Washington. Would you put the Canadiens in that group? It's hard to know because they haven't really been healthy.
But rediscovers that.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, in the West, there's always there's the eternal Chicago Blackhawks. There's a couple of other pretenders. Yeah, it has been an interesting year because it really hasn't gone according to the script that was set
Tampa
out.
Bay.
Yeah, you exactly. I remember talking about this at the start of the year. I mean, you could go down the list and there were about 8-10 teams in the Canucks position, a team that was rebuilding, a team that was trying to get younger, a team that was trying to integrate new players into their lineup. And have any of them really made a, I guess, Edmonton, but, you know, they've got McJesus, so that's, they're, well, that they're a different, coming, yeah. Yeah, a little different, but of all those teams, I mean, would have you picked Columbus as the team to emerge from that, you know, miasma at the start of the year?
Of Calgary, course not, but no. I've been picking Colorado for the last 4 years to have this young collection of talent that we're going to blossom like Edmonton was supposed to do.
112 points 2 years ago, like, did they win the – they either won the President's Trophy or finished second, whatever it was. But that's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, the way they've fallen off the clip. Calgary, you kind of, you know, yeah, no, from night to night, they're kind of in and around it. And so many teams. The Islanders have fallen off a cliff, although they change coaches, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're clawing their way back into it. So it's really hard to make those kind of, you know, sweeping definitive judgments on this league, because there's always seems to be like something contradicting it coming off the other side.
To me, when I look at the Canucks that way, at and it is funny that there were easily over the last 8 months, there were three periods where it clearly looked as if Willie DeJardin wasn't on his way out, he was, you know, the bus ticket was being written for him. But when I look at some of these teams, and you know, you are always expecting that next level of development, whether it was a Colorado who've slid back so far, or even a St. Louis who, okay, well, they took that step and then this one and then this one. Dallas is another one in that example that last year everyone goes, okay, they're putting the finishing touches and next year they're going to be a real contender. Maybe we underestimate how much a coach has an influence, or with that group, or with chemistry, or how much tinkering can blow it all up. Stability, I think, in hockey, especially when you look at someone like Jim Benning, people will say this, you need to give him time for his draft picks to develop, but people don't have that patience in the NHL. Seemed to me like the Canucks were really on the edge of making a major change. As I say several times in the last few months, the stability's paid off to this point, but that's no guarantee that they'll take the next step.
Well, no, absolutely not. And again, I keep hate coming back to that, but I think that's why these next 2 months are going to tell a story. I mean, we don't have to look too deeply into the history of this organization and the history of this ownership group, and they're not especially tolerant of missing the playoffs. And if they miss again, that's 2 years out. And where does that leave them? So, I mean, these are just quite the questions that can be asked. And I agree. You know, I think it's hard to know with Willie. Geez, you know, it depends on what moment of the day you ask the question. But I will say this. They played hard for him. They've competed. And I think he's gotten about as much as anybody could reasonably expect from this team to this point in the season. Benning, similar story. I mean, he's made some very adroit moves, and some of those draft picks look like they but you know, the big like the big glaring mistakes, two lottery picks that could have really changed the fortune. Maybe a Levy will, maybe Jake Virtanen will. Right now they're not contributing, and those should be spots where they're contributing. And the Louis Erickson contract, you're paying $6 million for what is essentially, you know, your seventh or eighth best forward. So
And tied to it
for the next 5 years. So, like, this can go any one of a number of ways, which is what makes it interesting, because it's not predictable and you don't know what's coming next.
I did have to laugh at the, you talk about Willie and you give him all this credit, but I had to laugh at the comments that he made about Stetcher. When Jordan Subban came up and didn't play, and it was this, as we've covered in previous podcasts and as you've written before, the things that have gone right to the Canucks this year, it's almost happened grudgingly. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't want Trampkin to play. They wanted him to go to the AHL.
Yeah.
They really, you know, they tried to stick Stetcher in the press box, and their hand was forced on this. This idea, this quote from Willie about how, no, I didn't believe he could play in the NHL. I thought his size was an issue, but he proved me wrong. And now that certainly Subban has done his part playing in Utica, but now all of a sudden, I don't know that you want two guys that small, but now all of a sudden it's like this hockey blueprint, which no one is allowed to kind of deviate from. They've been woken up that there is some possibility here, and that, you know, if you take a chance, sometimes you're rewarded. Yeah,
absolutely. My favorite is the Nikita Triamkin miracle diet.
Yeah.
Not ready to play. And the training system. Yeah. In the space of two weeks, he lost all the weight and got into enough condition that he could be like a legitimate NHL defenseman. Yeah.
One other story that's kicked around this week, I want your opinion on. I know that, you know, the great Canucks, goaltending soap opera that seemingly has gone on since Cesar Maniego versus Kurt Ridley, or maybe it was even Gary Smith versus Dunk Wilson. I'm not sure, but they're just this franchise is not normal when it comes to goaltenders. Now, reading this, thought that maybe Ryan Miller gets another contract. Jacob Markstrom is bypassed until they can pass the torch to Thatcher Demko. We saw this plan before with from Luongo skipping over Schneider to Eddie Lack, which didn't work out either, which is how we arrived at Ryan Miller. What do you think Ryan Miller's future will be and should be with the Vancouver Canucks?
Well, I think it depends on what price. And I think if they can get him for, let's say, 1 year at $4, maybe $5 million, I think they do that deal because he's for me, he's been their most valuable player. And their goaltending is really the thing which has separated them from all those other teams we've talked about. On a night in, night out basis, their goaltending gives them a chance to win virtually every game. And I think they love that idea. They love the idea of that veteran goalie and the presence he gives and the way it allows them to play a certain way in front of him. I think they like all those things, and I don't see them going into next season with that kind of question mark around two unproven commodities in Markstrom and Demko. Granted, they're, you know, I still look at Markstrom and he's got everything you want in a goalie.
And we're 27 now, right?
And 27
so
now.
Should so should be unknown
yeah,
to that.
Yeah, thing. Should be there. Should be there. Demko, an elite prospect. But do you turn over everything? Do you invest everything a season in those two goalies? I don't know. That's what I'm like from the organization point of view. I don't think they make that gamble.
Right. That's the microcosm in one position of what we've been talking about this whole podcast is you should say, you know what, if it costs us the playoffs or, you know, a season, we need to see if Jacob Markstrom is the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan Miller's certainly not going to take a backseat and go, okay, guys, yeah, I'll take my 20 games and that's it.
Yeah.
But as you said, they're probably not willing to do that. So, you know, then they wait for Demko and Markstrom's buy. I just find it where this team is to be eminently entertaining.
Yeah, well, no shortage of conversation topics, that's for sure. And there's, you know, a couple we haven't even touched on that we can save for another time.
Absolutely. So let's talk about something else that has permeated the sports world apart from hockey for the most part, and that's Donald Trump. And I found it very interesting. You and I have both been to Super Bowls. We know what it's like. We know that there's no hiding. Tom Brady is a veteran at this now, having been to 7. I thought some people have called it badgering of him about his friendship with Trump. It was such a huge story earlier in the week, but it's really gone away. People have dropped that bone. But, you know, Tom Brady stuck a Make America Great hat in his locker for 4 months and made no secret of the fact that, you know, even though he was aw shucks, this was a guy he supported. And all this just absolutely human garbage has been swirling around Donald Trump, and Brady just wouldn't be drawn into it. And I found it fascinating on this stage, actually, at his ability to duck and weave the story.
Yeah, and it also makes him a member of a very small minority too, because this is the one subject that athletes are not afraid to speak out about. In fact, it's been amazing. Just let me backtrack for a minute. I have expressed my political opinion about Donald Trump, which is not supportive, a couple of times, and invariably you get the response, as do a lot of people who are in my position in Twitter, stick to what you know. You don't know anything about. Okay, we're way past that.
Oh, yeah.
We are so past that. Everything will be defined by American politics. Anybody who's in a position where they're disseminating information, will be seen through the prism of Trump's presidency for the next 3 years, and I think we're at 11 months now. You just can't, and I don't see where you can be neutral. I don't see if you support him, then say it. If you have your own opinion, but this is what we're seeing. It is amazing. Because we're seeing characters like Russell Wilson, who might be the least controversial person in the end. He sounded off about Trump. Doesn't see him lasting the 4 years. Kyle Lowry, another very calculated. I mean, he stood up there and went, this is bullshit, this is bullshit, and repeated it. My favorite was apparently during the scrum, one of the TV guys said, can you say that without swearing? And Lowry went, no, just use your beeper. And then he dropped a couple of more bullshits on them. So, Dale Earnhardt Jr. signs off about it. You know, we were talking about it before, that the kind of the NBA coaches protest group, Stan Van Gundy, Steve Kerr, and Greg Popovich, God bless him, he might end up running for president. So it is made for a lively dialogue, and I'm just fascinated by it. I really am.
I mean, it goes back to the Michael Jordan debate that Jordan,
yep,
allegedly, to protect his relationships with Nike and Fruit of the Loom and Gatorade and who else, you know, just would not ever make a stand on anything. Yet other athletes have, and that's fine. You don't have to. That's been my problem with Brady, is that Brady, yeah, has been so chummy with Trump in the past,
yeah,
to so overtly support him, but then give that all-American smile and that bullshit. What's been going on in the world?
Yeah.
And then I'm a positive person, like other people are being negative. Come on, people are smarter than that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just not sure you can play that that neutrality card anymore. It's funny, you mentioned Nike, and I think I've got this story right, but I was reading about it just before I came. So Mo Farah, the 10,000-meter last two Olympics, has been training in Ethiopia. He's a Somalian. He lives in Portland.
Yep.
He's afraid of coming back. He doesn't know if he'll be able to get in. Well, Nike issued a release saying how they're in support of Mo Farah, and this is what America stands for. This is Nike, right? You see all those corporations that have banded together to say, you know, we stand for something. This isn't what America is. And I mean, these are, you know, some of the biggest corporations in the world. It's amazing. I just never thought I would see this in my lifetime.
Have you seen the fuss? Again, same thing. You sit here and go, Nike, when have Nike ever spoken out against the establishment? Yeah. Have you seen the Budweiser issue around the Super Bowl ad?
I have. I'm sorry. Just very briefly, I saw the ad. I saw some of the debate over its appropriateness. See, on Fox.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, that, like, Budweiser? This one is accidental.
Yeah.
You know, a year ago, they planned to tell a story of the immigrant who founded their company, and now all of a sudden it's a political statement on what's going on.
Well, and I think that's kind of, you know, what I'm trying to say here is it colors everything. I don't think you can hide from it. It is everywhere and with everything and virtually everybody right now. Trump has, he's got a deep connection with one of the sports I kind of care about is golf, to the point where Bernhard Langer might be responsible for Trump's quotation about all the illegal voters, which cost him the popular vote. But again, that plays into it. It's funny. I went to interview Lexi Thompson. She was doing a day at Seymour Golf Course before the Women's Canadian Open at the Vancouver Club last year. And on her bag, she had a big Donald Trump logo. And this would have been 2015, 20. It was long before all this stuff started. I think he was just a candidate at this point, or he'd announced his candidacy. Didn't really have the weight it had now. But, you know, that bag now, I mean, God, that's dynamite. That is.
Absolutely. If you're making that statement, yeah. One of the things that struck me about all this, Ed, is that you do see how sports has been inclusive. And we can talk about, even prior to this, it was such a rough year for so many things last year. You talk about the protests and Black Lives Matter, and, you know, athletes traditionally have been so protective of their area. Sports writers stick to sports. You hear that over and over again. But you talk about this being pervasive, but you see athletes who have included Muslims and immigrants into their team and realize it doesn't matter. It's, you know, and they're actually standing up. Luol Deng, as we know, for the Lakers, all these guys have played with people who are impacted by this situation, which is why I am thrilled to see them speak up. Now, hockey, it comes from a different background. Traditionally very conservative. We talked about the coaches before. You know, I love to see Greg Popovich get up there and say what he wants.
Yeah.
As I say, I didn't have much time for Tom Brady dancing around the issue so with such smarm, but I wish hockey had a little more of this. I wish people would speak their mind, because we're not averse to these issues in this country either.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm not even going to go there. But I had a conversation with a member of the Canucks, and you can probably guess who it was. And he would not go on the record, but he had very, very strong feelings on the subject. But let's move on. You know, the other one I wanted to call to people's attention was Masai Ujiri, the Raptors gentleman.
Yep.
He has been holding basketball camps in Africa for a couple of years now. Well, he holds one in the Sudan. And, you know, they've developed, there's some great players that have come out of Africa in the last half dozen years. Well, now he doesn't know what the status is of that thing. Would he be able to bring players back while this ban is on? How long will the ban go on? What, I think we're at, 90 days, 120 days, whatever it is. But so the future of that camp, is up in the air. And I was thinking, you know, the sporting event where it'll have the biggest impact is the Olympic Games.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where are we with that? And I know the IOC has kind of talked around it, but I don't see where they've come out with a really hard-hitting statement outlining their position on this. But I mean, if you are a global entity that stands for the things the IOC says they stand for, there's only one position for them. And again, neutrality isn't it.
Yeah, and we all know where the IOC is traditionally stood too.
Yes.
one of the things there, another anecdote, I recall as a news reporter being sent to, at the time, GM Place to get Owen Nolan's thoughts on the Quebec referendum about whether they would remain part of Canada. Nolan had just joined the Sharks after, of course, being drafted by, by the Nordiques and spending, making a good deal of money there. And his response was unprintable. Made it clear he wasn't following it, didn't care whether Quebec was part of Canada. And it was just that doesn't affect me, like a complete rockhead as far as I was concerned. And that's what we're used to from a lot of athletes, but we're now seeing it spill over the other way. So that is interesting. I'm going to bridge this now as we finish with the Super Bowl, because one of my favorite and most layered and complex stories of the week surrounding the Super Bowl, Ed, is the fact that we get to see the American ads up here.
Mm-hmm.
This will tie all together, I promise you. I don't know if you've been following the story.
I haven't, so please, illuminate me.
They've had more than 100 complaints to the CRTC. About not being able to see the American ads on our broadcast here. You know, they like to serve us the same GMC ads 17 times each break. Because it was ruled by the CRTC that the ads have become such an integral part of the broadcast themselves, they cannot be excluded. So for this year, they cannot block out the American ads. CTV are now claiming that they will lose money because everyone will watch the American feed. No one will watch the Canadian feed and see those same ads over and over again. And therefore, Bell are laying off people because of what's happening here. Sure, that's the reason why. So Bell appeal to the Prime Minister's office. The Prime Minister's office says, hey, we can't get involved in the CRTC. It is its own entity. It's separate. Mm-hmm. It must remain unbiased. Bell then appeal to the NFL, who have put the file on Mr. Donald Trump's off table. So Donald Trump, apparently, the statement from his spokesperson was, yes, this is on the president's radar.
Oh my
the
God.
Fact that CTV has a file on Donald Trump's desk because we get to see the American ads. I don't know why that story fascinates me so much, but it does. So we will see the American ads for the first time this year.
As much as everything that is going on in the States now is fascinating. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny, because I can remember when I started off in Medicine Hat, watching Super Bowl games in the They'd have the ads on for like local car dealerships, local fast food restaurants, and then you'd have to wait. You know, this is the long before the days of YouTube, and then usually on the nightly talk shows, they would start like I never saw that famous Apple ad. Yeah. It took me about a week to actually see.
There was no YouTube back then. Yeah,
no, absolutely. No, it's incredible. Look, I mean, and I'm laughing, but at the same time, I'm absolutely furious that those assholes at Bell would play that card after they've laid off at the profit the corporation has shown. I understand there's divisions and all the rest of that. But I mean, Scott Rintoul, I've worked with him for a long time. I have a ton of respect for him. Same with Peter Shad. And I just think it's a tragedy that people like that are losing their jobs. That corporation is hiding behind that.
Absolutely. And seriously, that was one of the reasons why the story played for me so well. On that note though, let's talk about the Super Bowl quickly. And again, as you rightly said earlier, all this stuff that's happened in the U.S. and these policies and the unrest, they spill over. I kind of went into this week. I don't know why I've never really liked the Atlanta Falcons. I don't dislike them. And they're not one of those teams that I hate, like the scumbag Steelers. But overall, I didn't want Atlanta to win the Super Bowl. And I do admire Belichick's greatness. I think he transcends all sport to just look at the impact this coach has had. And I don't know that you can point to a single figure in any major sport that's had the kind of direct impact on the success of a team the way he has. So I was sort of, when we knew which two teams were in it, I was expecting to feel a little dirty about it, but pull for the Patriots. The whole Brady Act has made me like, no, I can't. I don't want to see him win another Super Bowl. But I look at it, I'm just hoping we get a good game. I can't remember a playoffs this bad. I know that the Chiefs-Steelers game was close and it came down to a missed two-point conversion, but that game was not good. The only game of the playoffs that was worth anything was Cowboys-Packers.
Yep, absolutely.
And so I know you actually went to the both Seahawks games. You saw the Falcons up close. I'm just hoping we get a good Super Bowl, really.
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated by that Falcons team, and you're right. They're probably the worst thing a team could be. They didn't inspire love. They didn't inspire hate. They just inspired apathy. And it was funny because I was sitting there in the Georgia Dome and I was looking at their list of retired players. And yeah, they're important to the franchise, but like Claude Humphrey isn't exactly one of the all-time greats in the NFL pantheon. But this team is different. I mean, it looks like it's special. It reminds me so much of the Seattle team that first won the Super Bowl in 2012. And it's different. I understand that, but it's the speed that defense plays at. And it's extraordinary to me that Dan Quinn has really built that defense over the course of half a season. Cause for the first half of this season, they were dreadful. But what they've done in the playoffs, I mean, like I say, they play mean, they play fast. They've got a couple of breakout stars people don't know about now, much the same way they really didn't know about Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright, or Sir Michael Bennett in 2012, but they're going to know. They're going to know about Neil, the free safety, a couple of those linebackers. And that's how good they are because I can't really remember their names right
Jesse
now.
Jesse Tuggle.
And then that's, there you go. Who's the first overall pick? Andre Bruce. They get the first overall
hybrid
pick.
Hybrid linebacker, they
turn him into Andre. And then the other thing, of course, is Matt Ryan has been on the most underrated run. I mean, he's the MVP this season, but I mean, really, for the amount of buzz he's caused, you very rarely hear his name talked about in kind of like as a break. And he should be a crossover star. He should be a crossover figure because what he's done is absolutely incredible. But that offense is scary good.
Yeah, honestly, and I, being a Bengals fan, I knew Mohamed Sanu was a good pickup for them.
Yeah,
Julio Jones might be the best receiver since Calvin Johnson retired, and so. You know, they've got these complementary pieces. They got two running backs. So again, passing, you're right. You look at some of the great offenses that we've seen. This sort of Kurt Warner. Okay. All my downfield threats were covered. I'll just dump it off to Marshall Faulk. The Falcons have that. I think we saw that in the Seahawks game. The Seahawks hung with them for the first quarter and a bit. And then it was just like they didn't know where to go to stop it. If there is a underworked player in the Super Bowl this year, it's going to be the Falcons punter. I mean, they drive after drive after drive. So I just, as I said, then you look at New England, the kind of run they're in, to think that they would have lost Rob Gronkowski, didn't have Brady for the first four games, and yet here they would be favorites in the Super Bowl. That's just more of the story of New England and what they've done.
I think this will be the ultimate test of Belichick's magic because it seems to me this whole Super Bowl boils down to the Falcons versus the extra week Belichick has had to prepare for him. Because I think when you line them up, player by player, position by position, you know, offense versus defense, I think you tick the boxes in the Falcons, but the one that kind of, you know, the X factor is Belichick. And it's amazing. I was just sitting here thinking, you know, like I've been able to cover a couple of Super Bowls, but it's funny. So
including the last Falcons one where Eugene Robinson was the story.
Well, yes,
of the game
we were both
before.
There. Yeah. That was a little different era in our business, wasn't it? When we sent two people to the Super Bowl. No, but what I was going to say was I covered the 2002 where the Patriots really start. And I think we can call them a dynasty. They have been so good for so long. In Brady's first year, he'd taken over from Drew Bledsoe. So that's the first picture. The second one is the 2009 one where they go undefeated up until the point where David Tyree makes that stupid catch off his helmet. So now we have another one, but we're talking about the space of 15 years now. And it's been Brady and it's been Belichick. And that is remarkable.
Is there another guy from any of those teams who makes the Hall of Fame? Maybe Will Fork? Maybe Gronkowski.
Perhaps. No, but you get but into
the
these. Most,
yeah, you look at the Steelers, you look at the 49ers, and it's multiple players from those eras that go in.
I know.
And there's really only two slam dunks here.
No, I know. Does Randy Moss count? He was really only for a couple of years. No, I mean, the guy I always think of when I think of, you know, was Troy Brown, who was a phenomenal player, but he was more a kind of, you know, a curiosity piece because he could play so many different positions, but he was the perfect Belichick player.
Even this year, you'd say their best young lineman, Chandler Jones, they traded away, and then midseason they get rid of their best linebacker in Jamie Collins.
It's crazy.
Send the poor bugger to Cleveland.
I know.
And yet here they are in the Super Bowl as a favorite. I've never seen anything like it. There's something about Belichick where he is, whether it's the just preparation or he's just smarter than everyone else.
Yes. So, you know, we'll see what happens here.
All right, Ed, thanks for joining us. Everyone, thanks for listening. We will, when we can fit these in, we will endeavor to do them every Thursday. Aside from one of these other factors that we never know that might prevent us from doing that, but thanks for listening, and we hope to get these to you more frequently.